Gods Under Jones Live today, Thursday the 2nd of May. On this edition, St Andrews has signed up to the principles of responsible investment. We find out what this actually means. As figures emerge showing the true number who died in Somalia's famine this decade, we ask why famines still happen. After 5.30, the Vice Principal of the University, Lorna Milne, talks about the first year of the new academic calendar. And finally, graduating student Dan Franklin will tell us how he's found St Andrews to be and if it's as good as it really claims. That's all here on Alexander Jones Live. You can follow me on Twitter as well. I'm at Mr. Jones News. And this is the last edition of the programme for this academic year. We begin today's programme with the University of St Andrews. The university has become the second in Europe, only the third in the world, to sign up to the principle of responsible investment. But what does this actually mean? And do students really care about how the university spends its money? I'm joined by Arlette Marjok, who's been one of the people behind the scheme and is a PhD student here at the university. Welcome to the programme.
Hello.
So, this has been described as an approach to investment by the university. Will this really make any difference to the way that they approach things?
I think in the long term it will, because the whole idea of the principles for responsible investment is that it's an ongoing commitment to the principles. So to kind of continually improving the way you invest. We don't necessarily call it ethical, but in reality it can be, if the organization signing up is willing for it to be that way. You asked the question, do students really care about how the university spends its money? Definitely they do care, because this came from the students actually. It was the students who reacted to the university withdrawing some of its funds from the SRI fund by Aviva and putting it in the mainstream fund last year. And they came to us, to our department, asking us, you know, how could you just explain to us what this means in terms of finance? And we told them, well, it's probably because they kind of think that the returns will diminish because it's an SRI fund, whereas that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And the PRI also says that quite clearly, that it is a commitment to an ongoing integration of environmental, social, and governance criteria into investment, which does not conflict with returns. So it's really a win-win situation, because it's an opportunity for students to, well, they've already showed that they're active and that they can be activists, but the PRI also has a platform for shareholder activists, so to say, through which students and the university can join engagements with investors or with stock exchanges, etc., on a range of issues that the students might care about.
So do you maybe want to explain it a bit in depth, what some of these principles are and what they actually mean?
So responsible investment is a kind of collaborative effort in the way that the PRI defines it. It's a collaborative effort for the investment community to be more sustainable and more long-term in its investment choices. And now what this actually means in terms of investment is that you integrate into your decision on whether to invest in a stock or to sell a stock or to hold it or to engage with a company on an issue based on those three things, so environmental, social, and governance criteria. So things relating to the environment, things relating to relationships with society, social growth, well-being, etc., and governance. So that means the fairness of the organization within itself. So no fraud, no insider trading, etc. So we integrate these factors into the way we look at a company. You don't just look at the financial performance of the company and just look at PE ratio and decide, oh yeah, we're buying it. You first look at those criteria and then you integrate that into your decision. And this is meant to, A, bring you better long-term returns. It means that there's less of a likelihood that your stocks will all of a sudden drop within a day because of some sort of governance crisis or governance controversy. And it means that for endowments or pensions like the universities, we are not only giving our beneficiaries money, but we're also giving them, you know, a world which is more stable and responsible and sustainable.
You talk about student activists here and how they've come to you and they've been campaigning for this for a while. Would you accept that that's still quite a small number of students and doesn't necessarily show interest among the general student population?
I'm not 100% familiar with the student campaign, but I remember that there were quite a few students who were at our school who talked to us. And then I think there was an action where some of them were camping out in St. Sylvester's plot, I think, overnight to show their support. So I would say it was decently supported by the student community. It can always be more.
Why do you think it took St. Andrews so long to sign up to this then, if it's such an obvious step as you're talking about?
I think they were just waiting for the push from the students, because I think the university really, at the end of the day, cares about what the students want. So they wanted that explicit, you know, wish of the student community to do this.
It's not just about the fact that Edinburgh's now signed up and following?
No one really knew that Edinburgh signed up. We only literally found out today. And also James Gifford, the CEO of the principals, only found out today. We were convinced that, you know, we're the first in Europe. So, no, it had nothing to do with Edinburgh's decision.
And so St. Andrews, you thought they were the first in Europe, second in Europe, third in the world. Yeah. Is this really St. Andrews leading the way on something that's going to become bigger and bigger?
I really think it is, yeah. The first university was a Canadian university, Carleton University, and from Ottawa, Canada. But that's North America, you know, it's a bit separate, it's a different world. It's also not quite up to the academic standard and the fame of University of St. Andrews. So I think University of St. Andrews signing is, I think it's leading the way, yeah.
How influential do you think we are? Is this going to make other universities sign as well?
I hope so. I think that if we highlight it enough, then I think other students, you know, will catch on and kind of realize that they would like their universities to do this too. Because, you know, young people are the generation that really care about ethics and ethical investing and the finance and sustainability connection. So I think there's a great potential there.
Do you think some of this increased attention on ethical investment is just because we've simply got no money at the moment? We're in an economic bad time in the cycle. Do you think that when we move back into good times, presuming that we do so in the foreseeable future, that actually people will forget about ethics and it'll become money, money, money?
Well, I don't know, but I don't think so. So I can't predict what the market will do. But I think that judging by how large this trend has become, I'm not sure if it's going to just go away and stop altogether once we start getting bigger returns. Because right now, simply money-wise, there's around a third, a fourth of global assets under management in the world signed up to the PRI already. And it's gaining momentum. I mean, there's signatories popping up everywhere all the time. So it really seems to be a growing trend and something that the investment world is continuously discovering, not just because of the crisis or not just because of the ethical side of it. That's just one of the sides of it. I'm sure that, that's been documented, the crisis has played a role in it. But I think that, you know, it's grown beyond that since.
And one of the things that we've seen in St. Andrews has been a reasonably poor image in the wider media of this town and this university. Do you think that this will help to show that we're caring people, that this is actually quite a friendly university?
I hope so, yeah. I hope so. It's a very sensible way to turn around some of the news stories we've had in the past few months.
And could you maybe explain a bit to us just what's happening tomorrow when we've got the chief executive coming?
Yeah. Tomorrow, James Gifford, the CEO and the founder, actually, of United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment, he first got the idea when he was interning at the UN. He's visiting St. Andrews to hopefully co-sign the PRI principles with Louise Richardson.
Hopefully.
I'm not sure if Louise Richardson has committed to be there in person or whether she will just sign at a later time, not during the event.
So that's okay.
To be confirmed. But I don't know if she'll be there at the time or if she'll just there later on or earlier for a photo shoot. Anyway, 3:00, there's free wine and a reception at the Gateway. So, tiny bit out of town by St. Andrews standards, but not too far. Plus, there's free wine, so always. And James will give a speech. He is a fantastic speaker, and he's incredibly inspiring. So you should all come along and hear what he's got to say.
Thank you very much for joining us on the programme. Aletta Majok, thank you very much.
I'll let
you get your train now. We're joined as well by the Director of Representation at the Students Association, Amanda Litherland, who's just getting into place here in the studio. And Amanda, the union really have been pushing for this scheme for quite a while. Why do they think that it's taken the university so long to listen to the students if this is, as we've been hearing, really what the students want?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I know it's taken a while, a few years, for this to actually happen. But like we say, we're the first to sign up to it. I think maybe it's just because it takes the university a while to do these things. But I've heard really great feedback from university staff and court members that this is something great that we should really be doing more of. And, you know, when you do read the principles of responsible investment, it's something that's kind of, a lot of it's common sense, and you wonder why we haven't done this before and why other universities aren't doing it. But yeah, I think it has taken a while, but I mean, we can definitely say it's a good thing that something we've done and that they're listening to what students want.
Your Director of Representation, how many people speak to you about ethical issues and say that they want a more ethical university? Is it high up there on the list of concerns?
To individual day-to-day concerns, I'd say it was more Freddie that deals with the kind of sustainability side of things. But I do know that it's something that's very important to students. We've got so many different student societies that are dedicated to sort of sustainability issues and things like that. And I think it is something that even if students aren't actively involved with it in a society or whatnot, it's something that I'd say the majority of students are in favour of. For example, whenever like the SRC ever votes on something of this nature, you know, there's always massive support for it. And I think it's, you know, in the world today, something that we all really need to think about and sort of sign up to these things, because, you know, we've got to make the changes now. The majority of students, I'd say, are in favour of this sort of thing.
How ethical are the Students Association in the way they conduct their business?
We have for a while been signed up to a lot of things, such as, you know, we have a sustainability policy and the way we sort of source our, whether it be like the ingredients for our cafe or when we buy new things. Because we're a university building as well, that's sort of set under what the university's rules are, but, you know, we are signed up to these sort of codes of good procurement to make sure that everything's sustainable. I do think there's more scope for us to take it further. Again, I'm not the best person to say, because sustainability is mostly under the president. But, you know, I think that students should be on it and should always be asking these questions and saying, you know, where are you getting this from? How is this happening? Especially with our redevelopment, you know, ask the questions, say, where's this come from? Where are you getting your materials? Where are you getting your ingredients for your food? But I think especially, you know, when we see the rise of a lot of student societies like the Conflict Free Campus Coalition, you know, it's a massive movement, and it's something that all students, a lot of students are invested in.
But how massive really are these movements? You know, we have 7,700 undergrads here, and they might, the strongest of these movements might have a couple of hundred people involved.
I think I know what you mean. It is growing, but like I said, I think even though not that many students take an actual active voice in it, I do think that, you know, if we're taking the conflict-free campus for an example, they had their conference, which was really successful last month, and it's only when big issues like this come up that I think the majority of students actually realise that it's something that we still need to talk about. I think it does take big things like the university signing up to this kind of thing or something really high profile that would get a lot of people interested.
Are the university responsive to the association when you go to them and talk about various schemes like this? You know, this has taken a while to get going.
Yeah, absolutely. No, they do listen, and, you know, I can say from having worked with them, they're always responsive to this kind of thing, because it only makes them look good as well if they sign up to it. And, you know, we're the first university in what is it, the UK?
Second, Edinburgh.
Second.
Edinburgh's been there, yes. Third in the world.
Third in the world, well, exactly. So, you know, it's good for us. I think it does sometimes take a while, especially when it's to do with something financial, because obviously we're talking about a lot of money moving around accounts. It takes a while, and they have to make sure, like, as a charity, that the money it's responsible to do that. But if there's no significant reason why not, then the university is always very responsive to it, I've found. But just keep the pressure on, I'd say, and keep doing more of it.
Amanda, thank you very much for joining us here on the programme. Thank you.
Thank you.
260,000 people have died. That's a number which would cause action from many governments around the world. But that is the number of people that the Famine Early Warning System Network, a US-based NGO, estimate have died in Somalia from 2010 to 2012. They died not from war, but from famine. So why is this still happening in the world today? Mark Gregory is the Star News editor, and he joins me in the studio to analyse the situation. So, Mark, welcome.
Welcome.
We, as humans, like to think that we're in control of things that are going on. Is there nothing that we can do to stop famines?
It's difficult to say. I mean, from a country so far away, I mean, you know, distance-wise to Africa, and also, you know, in the state of our economy, the state of our lives generally, it can be quite difficult to you know, remind ourselves that these things are still going on, because obviously from our position, we don't have that much famine in our country, if at all. And you know, especially the you've got the, you know, the leaders of the biggest nations, the G8 and all that kind of stuff. It's difficult to sometimes for people to realize that these things are happening, and obviously they do happen, and people are dying from famine. And obviously it's not the famine isn't just you know, because of a lack of food. It's also because of various other contributing factors, like, you know, the war in Somalia, obviously, and things like that. But it, yes, I think it can be it's a bit of a blind spot sometimes in the thought process of governments of countries like the UK and the US.
Do you think there's an element in that actually in the West, governments, maybe not ordinary individuals, but those running countries actually choose to allow these to happen? They know that there's something they could do.
I think the situation in Somalia was difficult because there was a radical Muslim group who were denying the fact that there was a famine, and they were refusing to have people from the West aiding the country. But at the same time, there should have been something done more quickly, more urgently to, you know, act upon this famine that was clearly, you know, that was clearly happening and happening until the start of last year. And I think, you know, that things can be done, things should be done, because there are things that happen in the UK where, you know, we're spending money on, you know, the Olympics, or, you know, a new football stadium, or, you know, things like that, where we're spending money on things that, yes, are good to spend money on and are good recreationally and entertainment wise. But if there's things like this happening in countries like Somalia and the rest of Africa, then it does seem a little bit superfluous to have these kind of things.
Now, you've just taken over as news editor here at Star. Mm-hmm. We're a small media organisation, we're student media. Yet we have outlets on Twitter, Facebook, we're here broadcasting around the world on the internet, and we have our own website where articles are going up. There's a lot of content that we can generate, and we're just one of a number of media outlets in this small town alone. There's a large global media that's growing day by day. Do you think that actually part of this is that people are just poor Africans? We've seen it all before.
Awareness is an issue, obviously, and there are, I feel there are a lot of very short-sighted people in life in general. I'm not going to make a comment on the caliber of people that we have here in St Andrews, obviously, because that's, you know, that's just a stereotype that I don't really want to touch upon. But I've been to Africa myself, and I've been there and helped out an orphanage in Uganda twice, and it does give you a completely different perspective on life, because I went out, I was 17 the first time I went, and I was in the middle of doing my A-levels, and I thought, you know, at the time, oh, my A-levels are really important, I need to do really, really, really well in my A-levels to get to university, to get myself a good job. But if you go out there, you're like, well, actually, the amount of stuff that I have, like, even if I didn't get a job at all and I was living on the streets, I'd still be in better shape than the majority of people living in certain African countries, which I think is pretty diabolical, to be honest. And the fact that people here in the UK get things like, you know, unemployment benefits, and obviously, you know, people are searching for jobs, but I mean, that money could be used for, you know, to alleviate famine in African countries. I'm not saying that's how it works, but, you know, there are things to consider that, you know, external factors and external issues that should be considered over certain things in the UK. And I think, you know, obviously things like Star, ourselves, and other student radio stations can spread that awareness, but there's only a certain amount that we can do as a small student radio station, because we're not suddenly going to start getting listeners from, you know, every country in the world, because, I mean, how many people are going to actually, you know, physically listen to St Andrews Radio?
Although, of course, you're welcome to wherever you are.
Of course, yeah. I'm not saying please don't. But I'm saying there are, you know, how many people in the world actually know about St Andrews Radio? And we can help, but it's not down to us to spread this awareness. It's down to governments. It's down to big news organisations and charities as well to spread the information and spread awareness about these kind of things.
It's interesting that you've taken the angle there that it's almost a lack of awareness from the major news organisations, because actually one of the criticisms has been the other side of that, which is actually too much awareness, because people are too used to it. They've seen these images before. We get them on our screens day in, day out. The news channels can show you that actually the problem for them is that people are fed up of hearing a story about starving Africans.
Yes. I feel like in St Andrews as well, there is a lot of charity stuff going on. And I agree, sometimes it can get a bit, oh, well, I've already given £10 to UNICEF this month, or I've already given £10 to this charity, you know, why should I keep giving? But at the same time, you know, I think awareness is good, but I think you can't be too aware of something. And... okay, people are getting maybe fed up about it, but it's, again, like I say, it is partly down to the public, but we're not the ones that have the money or the power to make the difference. And it is down to governments and organisations around the world to, you know, act more, because they're the ones who have the power. They're the ones who have the ability to resolve these problems. It's not, you know, I mean, obviously, charities can do that, and we can all donate to Oxfam. But if there is not, yeah, you know, if like you say, we are becoming too aware, we're becoming fed up about it, and we're not giving anymore, then there's only a certain amount that the charities can do. Whereas governments are always going to have the money and the ability and the power to make a difference.
Now, again, there's the issue of people and the issue of the government there, because one of the things that we've seen this week and is the aid to South Africa being cut by the UK. Mm-hmm. And in general, they're trying to raise the aid budget and taken by DFID. But there's a lot of the public who feel that in this time of economic hardship, giving abroad isn't actually appropriate, that people need to focus money here. Do you think that people are generally aware of problems around the world and that they really care for these things?
I think they're aware of them. I think they care about them, but I don't think they realise how bad they are. Which is, again, like I say, having been there and actually been to a country that has very little compared to us here, I think people don't realise. It's one of those things where people hear about things and they're like, oh yeah, but it's fine. But until they actually see it, they don't realise how bad it is and how bad it can get. And I think that's part of the issue, is that people are very comfortable in their own lives, and people can get very selfish, and they think, oh, I'm fine, so why should I be, you know, giving to this person who I don't know anything about, and I've only ever seen on TV and the news. But once you've actually been out there, once you've actually affected the lives of those people, and you actually understand what, you know, what they have and what they don't have more poignantly, then that can help, you know, inform your decision a lot better.
And in many ways, if what you're saying is true, then that's actually going completely against the principles of globalization, because people aren't feeling more in touch with people across the world. They're seeing it, but they're not quite making the next step. They're still staying in their own little bubble.
I think people are very people like comfort, and for people to go out to Africa, obviously having experienced this, like I say, it's a massive step out of your comfort zone. And, you know, I remember when I went out and was taking the malaria tablets and everything, and I got pretty much every single side effect from the malaria tablets you could possibly get. And that's not a comfortable feeling. And you know, there was a couple of times where I felt very homesick, and, you know, I was almost glad to only be out there for 2.5 weeks, you know, rather than a lot of people I know who go out there for sort of months on end. But it's difficult because people do like to stay in their comfort zone. If they've got a comfortable life, you know, the family and all that kind of stuff, it's very difficult to get people out of that habit, out of that comfort zone. And yes, obviously globalization through things like internet and television and all that kind of stuff is a great positive step. But yeah, there is still a lot, you know, people aren't going to go to Africa for a holiday. They're always going to go to somewhere like, you know, Spain or Italy, where they know they can enjoy themselves, relax, and, you know, that's because obviously people feel very stressed from their everyday lives, and, you know, to get away from that, they're going to go to somewhere like Spain or Italy. They're not going to go and...
Because of the politics of Africa as a...
As well, yes. I mean, Somalia at the moment, or during the time of the famine, was one of the most dangerous places for aid workers to be, but ironically it was the one that needed the aid workers the most, which was the most difficult part about the famine, was... because they needed the help, but they couldn't get it, or people were reluctant to go because it was so dangerous. And I think that was part of the problem, I think.
So in many ways, if the local political situation was improved, if the danger was removed, then these other issues, the famine, would disappear because it's down to the politics.
Yes, but that's easier said than done. You can't automatically go to a country like Somalia and go, actually, I don't want any war in here, because that's, you know, you can't just, that's impossible.
Because I'm quite interested that if this number of people, 260,000...
Half of which were under fives.
Yeah. If they died in a war, if that was going on in any war zone around the world, I suspect we'd be hearing a lot about intervention from the Security Council, from the big powers around the world. Yet, in a famine, can that almost go unnoticed?
Yes, because it's not as obvious in a way. I mean, if you've got a war, you're always going to have, you know, battlefields and you know, casualties, war casualties. Whereas with a famine, it's very, you know, it can kind of go, it can slip under the radar. I completely agree, it can slip under the radar. And obviously, as these reports are showing today, the number that was estimated is far lower, that was estimated during the time of the famine, was far lower than the actual number that they've now had scientific data for, which is, you know, is again indicative of the fact that these kind of things can go under the radar slightly, because if you've got a war going on, that's where all the media focus is going to be on, is on the war and the war casualties, and you're not going to notice as much the casualties from famine, which is a very sad situation.
This current information makes it one of the worst famines in 25 years, and that's in the time we've seen Band-Aid, we've seen the newer version of Band-Aid, we've seen many campaigns like this. Have they had any effect?
I think it's unfair to say they've had no effect at all, because I think the situation in Africa is improving, but there are always going to be certain countries, certain political governments, certain situations where things are going to get worse, or you know, manifest themselves in a certain way where things like this are going to happen. The difficulty is pinpointing that and acting upon that as quickly as possible, which is where this famine in Somalia broke down slightly, in that the awareness wasn't quite there. And the governments weren't, because this famine was denied by the people in Somalia at the time, the governments weren't, you know, weren't able or weren't willing to act upon that as quickly as they maybe should have.
Star News editor Mark Gregory, thank you very much for speaking to me about that. Thank you. And still to come on the programme today, we'll be hearing the interview I recorded yesterday with the proctor of the university, one of the vice principals, Lorna Milne. She's talking about the change to the academic calendar, including the abolition of Reading Week and the moving of exams from January to December. How did that go in the first year? You can hear my interview with her in just a few moments. And then at the very end of today's programme, the last programme for this academic year, I'll be speaking to Dan Franklin, a graduating student, about his time here in St Andrews. And does it really match up to what you would expect from the sixth best university in Britain? But now, let's get the latest headlines from Star News. Becomes second in Europe to sign investment pledge. Local elections underway in England and Wales.
Live from Star Studios, this is Star News.
With the 5:30 Star News, I'm Alexander Jones. The University of St Andrews has become the second in Europe to sign up to the principles of responsible investment. The UN-backed scheme already includes over 1,000 companies and $30 trillion of assets. Edinburgh University has already joined. CEO of the scheme, James Gifford, will visit St Andrews tomorrow, Friday, when University Principal Louise Richardson will formally sign up. The Students' Association had encouraged the university to sign to the scheme for a number of years. Local elections are underway in England and Wales. Just 2 years before the next general election, the polls are expected to show gains for Ed Miliband's opposition Labour Party. The United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, are also expected to do well, with analysts predicting they will take seats from the Conservative Party. Figures out today show 260,000 people died in Somalia's famine from 2010 to 2012. The US-funded NGO who carried out the study said this is one of the worst famines of the last 25 years. 10% of all children under 5 in the affected region are estimated to have died. Overall, 4.6% of the population died. And that's the latest Star News. For more, go online to standrewsradio.com. The 2012 academic session was one of the first in a newly structured year. Semester 1 underwent a number of changes, including the removal of Reading Week and the shifting of exams to before Christmas. So how successful has the new academic calendar been? That's the question I asked the Proctor and Vice Principal of the University, Professor Lorna Milne, when we met up yesterday.
I think that it has been broadly successful, in fact very successful. I think that there were a number of things we were trying to achieve that we've definitely succeeded in achieving. The main one being that the university's carbon footprint in January is now far more respectable than it was. It was always surprising to me that students came back for exams in January and then didn't stay here until the start of semester two. A lot of them went back off home again or went travelling, and that meant that there was a lot of coming and going in January. It's the worst time of year to be travelling in Scotland. There was a lot of disruption to the travels that people were trying to undertake, and getting back for an exam when the weather was bad in January just added to the stress of having an exam. So all of that we've done away with, and although the town was exceptionally quiet in January and not all the restaurants and bars were very happy about that, actually from the point of view of doing good to the planet and also letting students relax over Christmas and not have to worry about coming back for exams, I think that's been a big success. The things that were more challenging, I think, were mainly to do with what everybody says, staff and students, was the relentless pace of semester one. I think that we knew that that was going to be tough and that people were going to find it quite tight, very compressed, and it proved to be the case. So that's something that's been a little bit less successful. But broadly, we have talked to a lot of students about it and taken soundings in the academic schools and all the units that deal with students as well, sports and so on. And broadly, even though semester one felt quite tough for quite a lot of people, they've preferred it to be the way it is now when they weigh it up in the round against how it was previously.
So semester one was tougher. Academically, was there any change in the results? Did we see exam results fall or anything like that?
We absolutely didn't. We were very attentive to the fact that we ought to keep an eye on that. So before we even started the new semester one, we had the registry standing by to collect statistics on exam results. And they did that, and at the end of semester one, as soon as they could after the exams were all completed, they had a look at the statistics and compared them to 5 years' worth of statistics, because statistics move from one year to another. There isn't a definite pattern. You couldn't say that the average exam result was the same every year. They move up a little bit and down a little bit, but they're within a narrow band of movement, and you couldn't say that this semester one was down or up in regard to previous years. So as far as exam results, module results are concerned, no pattern of difference. Where we also wanted to collect some results was to do with student welfare, because we expected in advance that students might find things more stressful. So also, at the same time as we asked registry to keep an eye on the academic results, We asked student services to keep an eye on the numbers of students presenting to them looking for help during the semester. And their statistics are very slightly different. They show that they had more students coming in, not more students overall, they had fewer students overall coming in to see them, but of the students who came to see them, there were more reporting stress or anxiety or worries about deadlines and that kind of thing. And what their statistics tend to show is that the number went down, but the complexity of the cases that they saw went up. And they can tell that by looking at the number of people who came through the door, and then the number of times that the same people came through the door, and the numbers of types of interview they had to have with the people that they met when they were there. So we need to keep an eye on that. It's not alarming, but it's at least a suggestion that. I'll backtrack a second there. It's not alarming, and it suggests that it doesn't suggest that there is a causal relationship between a different semester one and lots more stress, but it does suggest that there is a perception of more stress and that it's happened at the same time as a different semester one. So that's something we just need to keep an eye on.
Has this increased perception of stress, whether it's there or not, actually had an effect on dropout rates? St. Andrews is known for having a very low dropout rate in the first place. Has that gone up at all over the last year?
That's a good question. So for undergraduates, not at all. There's really no difference. Again, we've looked at the statistics in comparison with previous years, not just last year, but a suite of years. Undergraduates, no, there's really not a difference. For taught postgraduates, the number of people who went on leave of absence last semester has gone up, but they're a very small number of students. It's a smallish cohort within the university anyway. So even when the numbers go up, we're not certain that that means that it was to do with the shape of semester one. But they went up, even for a small cohort, they went up by more than we might have expected. There were, for example, last year, I think there were about 15 top postgraduates who needed to take a leave of absence. This year, it was more like 28. So that sounds like quite a jump.
A significant increase, definitely.
In percentage terms, on the number that took leave of absence last year, it is, because it's doubled. On the numbers of postgraduates on leaves of absence, that just means that they're now in line with the undergraduates, whereas before it was a tiny number, it was a tiny percentage. So that may be that top postgraduates have been more affected, or it may just be that last year top postgraduates came into line with undergraduates. We don't know. But in terms of people dropping out, which is different from leave of absence, no change.
We've already touched on January a bit, but I just want to return to that briefly, because one of the things that we've heard from some members of staff, academic and in support roles, and also from students, is that they think the length of the break was too long. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you would agree with?
Certainly heard it from a few people, but I've also heard exactly the opposite. What we might look at doing, but this is just a tentative idea for the time being, is perhaps starting some sort of activities a little bit earlier, but not academic activities. So that might be a very good moment of the year to have things like an employability fair or more careers activity, the kind of thing that KPOD run for student development, you know, professionalisation curriculum. It's the kind of time that people could come back and get in touch with catching up with things in advance of semester two starting. But as far as the academic staff are concerned, they really needed January to get back to their research. So I've heard one thing and the exact opposite from both staff and students, and I think it's unlikely that we'll start semester two earlier in future. Certainly for the coming year, we won't make any changes to it, because we need to see how this beds down for a couple of years first. But it's just possible that we might do some sort of reorientation in semester two in future. And if students have got views about that, I'd be very happy to hear them. I've heard from the school presidents, and they were in favour of coming back a little bit earlier and doing something. So next year there will be an employability event that will at least run over the weekend prior to semester two. But if we were to bring it back any further than that, that would be a bigger undertaking. We'd have to see how we could manage to do that.
How seriously do you take the complaints of people in the town about what
has happened to their businesses in many cases, to their livelihoods, by not having students here in January, because over the summer for many of them they can make that up with tourism, whereas there's not much tourism here in January. So yeah, how seriously do you take that as the university?
That's a good point. You're absolutely right about there not being very many tourists in St Andrews in January. It was exceptionally quiet. But actually, the university is very good at keeping in touch with the Merchants Association and going along to the Community Council. And the stories of doom that were being spread around just before Christmas haven't all come to pass. I mean, I think a lot of us heard stories about this, and that restaurant was about to go out of business. I walk past them every day and they're still thriving as far as I can see. So I hope very much that once the town manages to plan in advance on the basis of their experience of this year, that there should be ways of keeping businesses afloat, which seem to have been successful this year, in fact. So if the town were to come to the university and say that we've got specific problems in particular areas, we'd do whatever we can to help. But the university calendar has got to revolve around education and the students' best needs. So that's what we're putting at the forefront.
If semester one is seen as being very busy, very packed in with lots of activities, do you think that maybe semester two is almost too leisurely? We've got a 2-week Easter break. We have two revision weeks that we're in now, not just one like semester one. Could this not actually be compacted a bit so that we finished slightly earlier or even started even later?
I'm certainly willing to consider those things. We need to look at the university's operation in the round again. But it's true that the 2 weeks for revision may be a bit too long. And this year we've discovered that even without hurrying exams, we can fit them into a shorter period. So there's every chance that we will try to compact that in future. But we don't know yet, until we're at the end of the process, exactly how it's going to have worked out. So I'm not keen to review anything until we can actually look back on it. So talk to me again in semester one next year, and we'll talk about semester two. It's not out with the bounds of possibility that we'll try and do something with the shape of semester two. However, a lot of students I've spoken to said to me, oh, we were really looking forward to semester two. We thought it was going to be so slow and so leisurely, and it hasn't worked out that way at all. And I think perhaps people who found they didn't have time for a lot of society and club and socialising activity in semester one are doing it all now. So the shape of the semester is different, but in quite a good way. So it may be that in the end we quite like it the way it is and we don't change it at all. As I say, we'll look back once it's over.
And there are many older students at the university who are still very nostalgic for Reading Week and would forgive me if I didn't raise that point with you. Do you think that there is any way a Reading Week could be introduced somehow into semester one by either teaching during Freshers Week or removing a week of teaching or starting earlier, any number of these things?
I mean, we do take that very seriously, and it's not just the students but the academic staff too who used Reading Week for reading and caught up with all sorts of things during that period. And I would love to put it back, but I can't put back a full week. It's just not going to be possible. We've looked at this every which way, and we can't fit in an adequate education that would start at the right moment of the year and that would finish before Christmas and put in a whole week. However, what I think we might be able to do is to introduce a long weekend in the middle of the semester, which will probably not be what the staff want. That may not help them with their programming of timetabling of classes. But in the end, when we carried out a lot of focus groups with students about how semester one had gone, we said to them, if you couldn't have a whole week, can you do with nothing? And they said, well, just give us a long weekend. So I hope that if we can at least experiment this coming year with a long weekend, about the end of week 6 or 7, that we'd be responding to exactly what the students are asking for. I mean, that's their, at least could they please have that? And we'll see how that goes. And I know it's difficult to give something to people and take it away again. So I would hope not to have to take it away again, but we're experimenting. And I think one of the good things about St Andrews is that we work a lot in partnership with the students. And I hope that the students understand that they're part of an experiment and we do what we can and we try things out. If it doesn't work for whatever reason, then we can't do it again. But the reason we're experimenting is that we're trying to move as far as we possibly can in the direction that the students want, so that we reach compromises that suit everybody as far as possible.
Now, if you go onto the university website, we can find the timetable going years and years forward, yes, way beyond the time that anyone who's here will be actually studying. So is there any flexibility in the system to actually make changes to the timetable?
I think that that set of dates just shows how far in advance we have to plan. For example, it wouldn't come home to students because it's not of particular interest to them, but we have enormous conferences organised for 5 or 6 years hence sometimes, and they take up all the lecture theatres, all the residence beds, that kind of thing, and they are absolutely essential to the academic activity of the university, just not to the activity of undergraduates. So, you know, you might think it'd be a perfectly easy thing to open Macintosh Hall a couple of weeks earlier, but you can't if it's full of art historians or theologians who are here for an international conference, and we need to host that kind of thing because we're a world famous, world class university, and we need to bring those people here from time to time. So, and those things are planned a long, long time in advance. So that's the kind of practical consideration that we have to try and fit in with the students' timetables, but the students also have sometimes to realise that we've got those activities going on too. So we do have to plan a long way in advance, but if we think that we need to plan for something different a long way in advance, then that's what we'll start doing.
But ultimately, there is not really any flexibility in the system to make any changes in the coming 4 or 5 years.
Very little flexibility in the next few years.
Finally, you also got responsibility for working with the Students' Association.
Yep.
How do you feel that the relationship between the union and the university has evolved during your time as proctor?
I think it's been absolutely super. It's one of the nicest things I do. It's one of the most pleasant activities in my job. The sabbatical officers are the most incredibly dedicated, energetic people. And I know that if I send them an email at 11 o'clock at night saying, oops, sorry, forgot to mention this to you, have you got any views on it, I'll get a message straight back because they're up and they're working even in the middle of the night. I know that I'll get sensible advice from them if I go along and say, we're thinking of, for example, changing what we do to the academic calendar, how would we go about sounding out students around that? I'll get responses from them, and they won't lie to me or tell me what they think I want to hear. It's just a terrific relationship, and I would have to say that that goes for everybody in this building. We all really enjoy our contacts with sabbatical officers and with the other students in the union that we meet beyond them, because, you know, I meet people on the, I'm on the Students' Association board, so I meet the officers that attend that. I bump into the SRC people from time to time, although not as many of them as I would like, and I've put in a bit of extra work this year at meeting a few more presidents of clubs and societies and that kind of thing, and I'll do that again next year. But absolutely, it's one of the most interesting things that I do, and it's one of the things that allows me to be really proud. If you look over there, there's a certificate in my room, which I don't have any right to at all, which the charity Childreach came to present to the university the other day. And so we had a nice meeting in my office with Meg Platt and some of the students who have been taking part in Childreach, and I pretended that I was responsible for the whole thing and accepted the plaque on behalf of the university. And Meg's going to take it back to the union any time, but I'm keeping it in this office because I've got lots of important visitors in and out of here. I think it's just really important that they see that here's something that the students have done. It's in my office because I've got a relationship with the students, but I'm absolutely not responsible for any of it. It's just really nice that one of the things I can do is to remind people around the university that students are what we're all about, and that they really deserve us giving them our best shot because they're terrific people.
Is it fair to say?
Doesn't it?
Do you think it's fair to say the relationship's always been like that over the last few years? Because, as the union will quite openly say, not this year, the year before, there was a complete breakdown in the relationship with the university. Would you be able to describe it in the same terms you've just used then if I was asking you this question a year ago?
I just wouldn't at all agree that there was a complete breakdown. There really wasn't. I had regular meetings with all sabbaticals last year. They were good-humoured. We had a lot of fun together, in fact, and they did some very good work, and they did good work on behalf of the university. Just take something like the redevelopment of the Students' Association building. This year's sabbaticals have worked hard on that, but last year's actually got us through the toughest part of it. and they put in a huge amount of work on that, particularly Patrick O'Hare. He was splendid. So I would have to say that my relationship with the sabbatical officers and the union through them has been good and remained good. And I couldn't say that there was a breakdown at any part of the relationship with people in this building last year. There have been challenges and different political points of view or different agendas that sabbatical officers or the university for that matter want to pursue can produce clashes, but that can happen in any year. And, you know, there have been things that Freddie and I haven't agreed on. We get over it, we move on. Just the same as in previous years, no doubt, there have been similar relations. So the main thing is that we know we've got to work together and we're committed to doing it, so we just make it happen.
The Proctor, Lorna Milne, speaking to me yesterday when I met up with her. The University of St Andrews has been named in Scotland and the UK as the sixth best university. But we wonder, does it match up to these expectations? Well, this is our last programme for the academic year, and we have a graduating student with us. Dan Franklin has been involved with many things at his time at university here, and he's here with us in the studio. Welcome, Dan. So, how have you found the student experience in St Andrews? Has it matched your expectations?
I think there are two sides of the student experience. We need to distinguish between the social and general life that are provided by, for instance, societies, the union, the university's funding of both of those things, and there's the academic side, the teaching side. And I think the social life is excellent. I've talked to people from other universities, and there is not really any dispute that we are one of the best for fostering societies, for fostering student involvement, for fostering student activity. The teaching, on the other hand, is not up to par. We are not, I don't believe, the best university in Scotland. We are one of a very small number of universities which does not require its academics to have a postgraduate certificate of academic practice, because we don't require any real teaching experience or qualifications, or for that matter, training in our academics. We have a very minimal level of requirement. We have a very minimal level offered on top of that requirement. But compared to other universities, we do not have the teaching expertise or experience here.
So if we look at academia then, are we not sixth in the UK? Research, taking into account research, teaching, the general academic department.
If we take into account research, we rise up the ranking significantly compared to other universities. The problem is that the teaching brings us down so badly. We are let down by the fact that because of funding, because of the way we're ranked, there's no incentive to teach well. Students come here because we're well ranked. We're ranked based mostly on research and student life. We are not ranked on teaching. What incentive does a university have to improve its teaching? None. So what improvement does it do for its teaching? None. Students don't pull them up on this because we're students. We'll get on and learn. We're learning despite our lecturers, not because of them. And I think that's a situation which we need to change.
Have you found then the society's experience, the social experience, is that better than anywhere else? Is that going to be top in the UK, do you reckon, more than sixth?
I'm not sure I'd say top in the UK. I mean, I don't know everyone at every other university in the UK, so I couldn't say, but it's certainly well up there. I mean, we have one of the highest levels of student involvement in society. We've got one of the widest set of interests represented by funded and affiliated societies. We've got really engaged students with the union, with the university on its academic society front. I mean, the fact that we get things like the school presidencies becoming so important, the academic societies, even things like, we've for a long time had a Harry Potter and Gin society.
Does it no longer exist?
It no longer exists. We now just have a Harry Potter society because they decided to get rid of the gin. You know, we have these very, they look like very specialist interests, but we foster them, and they clearly aren't that specialist because they're very popular.
One of the main concerns that you hear from people in their late secondary school career about St Andrews is they don't think there's this social life that they're after. They think that there's not the nightclubs that they want to go to, there's not the bars, the shops, whatever it is they're looking for, it's not here. Yet what you're suggesting is actually there's something far better here.
Yes, I think the thing is that if you're looking for a university experience which is made up of clubbing every night and going out drinking, St Andrews is maybe not the best place. We aren't a city. We aren't somewhere where you can roll from club to club around the city centre. But we are somewhere where you can get engaged with student life. we're somewhere where you can actually engage with other students outside the environment of a club. And that's a very different experience. And I have to say, I think it's a much better experience as a student in terms of social life.
Engage with other students? Literally? Get engaged?
At this university, apparently, yes. It's something like a third, a quarter of students, you know, leave with their future spouse or life partner. That's an incredibly high ratio, in part because we're so tiny, because you can't walk down the street without running into someone you know. We are that entity, we are that very close community, and that does have some disadvantages. Exam time, when everyone is so stressed. But most of the time, it's great for support, it's great for friendship, it's great for that feeling of knowing people.
And do you find that among your graduating friends? Have many of them hooked up with the partner for life?
I think it's a bit too soon to say, but certainly some of us have, you know, had long relationships running for years and years, which we look to continue long into the future. So, I mean, I don't want to say anything in case something goes tragically wrong. But even amongst some of my third-year friends, they are now married to people they met at university, which makes me feel a bit old. But at the same time, it's one of those moments where you just think, any other university, how often would this happen?
You've been very involved in the union here in your time at university. Do you think that life really revolves around the union, or is there a social life beyond societies?
I think that there are a number of nexi of social life. The union is one of them. If you pull societies into the union, it's quite a large one. But at the same time, every hall has its individual community. You get communities who move outside of halls. There are all sorts of communities completely unrelated to the union. It's just that the union is very good at fostering a lot of different communities in a way that no other institution in St Andrews really can do. But that's not to say there's no social life outside the union. In fact, there's a huge amount of social life which goes on outside the union. House parties, general friends getting together and living together. You know, you've got the close formed bonds of housemates. It's just that the union is very good at harnessing that energy in very productive and lasting directions.
Do you think it's negative in many ways, the inward-looking small-town nature of the place, where while we might get very involved in traditions like the May Dip, which was yesterday morning, thinking about yesterday morning in the early hours of the day, there's all these traditions that people get involved in here, and the students here do love it, but does it foster a certain sense of thinking about yourself and about others?
I think that there is a problem with the way we look at traditions, the way we treat the university, the way we almost reverse some of our traditions too much. But at the same time, most of our traditions revolve around being quite light-hearted. You know, the peer walk, we walk out, we walk back in a red gown, looking vaguely ridiculous, but every week we do that and we love it. Two of our biggest traditions are the May Dip, running into the sea half of the time while completely drunk, and Raisin Weekend, getting completely drunk and then having a foam fight. We have these traditions, they aren't serious, they are light-hearted, and they bring that sense of community to the university. We've all done it, we've all done the May Dip, we've all done Raisin Weekend. And that's something we all have in common as students and can therefore say, have you, you know, you did this, how was your experience of it? It's this commonality, this community we've got.
Finally, would it be fair to describe this as the Marmite University? Would you recommend it to people?
I have recommended it to a number of people already. I have to say that I think I've been here a bit too long now. I'm ready to leave, but that's because I come from a huge city, I'm used to cities, and 4 years is a long time here. But up until this last semester, there's been no place I would rather be. And this last semester, it's not just been sort of, I want to get out now. It's been, I want to get out now, but I want to stay at the same time. There's that tension even within one person over whether I love it or hate it. I think it, Marmite University is probably the best way to describe it.
Dan Franklin, thank you very much for joining us here on Star. And that does bring us to the end of the final edition of Alexander Jones Live for this academic year. Hopefully, we'll be back after the summer. But remember, in the meantime, you can get the latest news from standrewsradio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Jones News. But now from me and everyone here at St Andrews Radio, thank you for listening. Good night.
Tune in to Star, University of St Andrews radio station.
St Andrews' only radio station.
This is Star.
here at the studio by buzzing the studio from www.standrewsradio.com.